Hey, influencer, welcome to part one of our interview with Jay Baer. And Jay is the author of the New York Times bestseller Utility, which is a book all about how to create friend of mind awareness rather than being top of mind or even frame of mind. And in this interview, we talked with Jay about how to be a person on your social profiles, even if it's a page that you set up for your company or your business, and how to plan the content that you put out on social media. We also talked about his two-step approach for finding how best to reach your customers and how to decide what type of content to put out. For example, a Vine video versus infographics versus a blog post. And we even talked about how to find the correct media channels where you should put out your content. And Jay even shared a case study of how a realtor increased their sales by 400% in just 2 years by using Twitter and, of course, being otherwise useful. So without any further ado, here's Jay Baer. This is Esther Kish.
And this is Meta Muller.
And you just caught the latest episode of Born to Influence, the marketing show.
Hey, Jay, how are you?
I'm fantastic. And you?
Good, good, good. Thanks. Thank you so much for coming on board. And Jay, to those people who do not know you, could you tell us a little bit more about who you are, what you do, and how you got started?
That's a lot of questions. I am Jay Baer. I am the founder of a social media and content marketing consulting firm called Convince and Convert. We work with companies all across North America on social and digital marketing. I'm the author of a New York Times best-selling book called Utility, Why Smart Marketing is About Help, Not Hype. That's my second book. My first book was called The Now Revolution, written in 2011 about social business. I've been a digital marketing consultant since 1994, so I've been doing this for quite a long time, and have been involved in a number of consulting firms and agencies and things like that. My blog, Convince and Convert, is one of the best read social media and content marketing blogs out there, and I'm the host of the weekly Social Pros podcast, where we interview somebody who's a social media manager or a content marketing manager for a major brand and sort of get the inside scoop on what they're really doing day to day.
I want to know about the digital marketing in 94. What was that? You didn't say internet marketing. What was digital marketing like in 94?
It was pretty much internet marketing. I just don't say those words anymore. It was an interesting time. I mean, I was working as – my background is in politics initially. I was originally a political consultant a long time ago, and I did that for a little while, and then I went on client-side marketing. I was a marketing director for a big Fortune 30 company for a little while. And then I left there and went to work for the government briefly, and I was the spokesperson for the Arizona Department of Juvenile Corrections. So my job was to give tours of the juvenile prison system in the state of Arizona, among other things, and that job was not even as good as I just made it sound. So I was at a point where I was like, I will do any job other than this job.
Wow.
And I was having beers with some friends of mine from university, and they had started a few months prior the very first internet company in the state of Arizona. And they said, you know, this company is starting to get kind of big, and we don't know anything about marketing. And I said, well, that's fine, because when you say the words internet, I don't know what you mean. But I said, you know what, I don't care. I will do any job other than this job. So I walked in the next day, quit my job at the state government, and went to work for an internet company without ever having been on the internet. So that was an interesting time. And as it turns out, my partner in that firm actually invented web hosting. So
wow.
Before then, this goes way back. This is 20 years. Before then, if you wanted to host a website, you had to have your own server. So it was one server, one domain name. He invented the partitioning algorithm that allowed you to run multiple websites on the same server. So we literally were the only company in the world that could do web hosting. And then other people caught up, of course. But it went crazy. I mean, we went from a couple of hundred dial-up internet customers, you know, like, you know, that kind of, you know, dial-up modem thing. A couple of hundred dial-up customers in Phoenix to 1,200 hosting customers in 23 countries, and that happened in about 60 days. So, you know, you hear the stories of that era of the internet, the brand new era, and people sort of sleeping on the floor to reboot the servers at night. That is exactly what my experience was. I mean, it was that kind of a situation. But I've only ever done two things well in my life. One is convincing my wife to marry me. And the second is to literally stumble upon a career in the internet and having the good sense to never get out.
That's fantastic. That's really, really cool. So what is it that, fast forwarding to today, what is it that you do in terms of digital marketing, or is it more just pure marketing?
We do almost all digital marketing. We do some offline, but really there's a lot of people who are great at offline marketing who, you know, who know more than me and my company do. So we primarily work online, and so we have a few different facets to our business. We do large social media strategic plans and content marketing strategic plans for medium-sized and large companies. We help them figure out, okay, you're here, how do you get here, and what does that look like? We work with a number of companies as well as a large number of agencies, PR firms and ad agencies and integrated marketing firms, on an ongoing basis to answer questions, provide support and guidance, counsel, best practices, to make sure that their own social media digital marketing programs are getting better on behalf of their clients. And then we do a lot of work with sponsors and companies to help them spread their message about their software or their circumstances through our own media channels, so our blog, our podcast, our email, our ebooks, our webinars, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So Jay, what is the biggest difference? And I'm not talking sort of technology-wise, but let's just talk marketing culture-wise. What's the biggest difference between marketing today and, you know, way back when in the 90s?
Well, I think marketing has gotten a lot harder today because everything is a potential marketing vehicle. You know, I remember the times when we had three television stations and two magazines and a newspaper, and it wasn't very hard to do advertising then. It wasn't even that hard to do marketing because there weren't that many options. Now there's you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of ways. I mean, just think about just in a social media context. I mean, the number of ways that you can do social media, the number of ways that you can do social media advertising, you know, it's dozens and dozens just in that one little sliver of marketing. So you have to know a lot more about a lot more things to be a successful marketer today than you did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of the big takeaways, because I've been reading your book, Utility, which I think every marketer should be reading.
So I'm not supposed to hold up the book, right? I'm supposed to, like, that's what I'm supposed to, I don't have
them. Yeah, and I've only got a Kindle, so I can't really do much either. So.
Tragic, I don't have one right here.
Damn it. But you talk about different, let's just call them levels of awareness, or different ways that, you know, people are aware of you or your brand. Could you just tell us a little bit more about, about these different levels of awareness?
Sure. So the historical kind of way that we did marketing was to try to achieve top of mind awareness, right? That's a very common frame up for marketing. And the idea with top of mind awareness is that you have a sustained level of penetration into the marketplace, and usually you do some sort of advertising or public relations or community relations on an ongoing basis. That's where you see, for example, in my local newspaper here in town, there's a number of restaurants that advertise every Wednesday in the restaurant section forever, right? I mean, forever. And that is a top of mind awareness strategy, right? If you just kind of keep your name out there, the thought is that when somebody is ready to buy, when somebody is ready for Greek food, they're like, oh yeah, those guys have Greek food, right? And that people will connect those dots mentally in their own head because you've sort of been out in front of them for a long period of time. Well, the challenge is that top of mind awareness is a lot harder now because there are so many different ways to advertise. And consumers do not clump their attention in the ways that they once did. You think about anything that used to be sort of mass media, at least in the United States, isn't really mass anymore, right? Newspaper readership, which used to collect a lot of attention, has fallen off. Even television has become much more fractured and splintered. people sort of do a lot of micro behaviors in terms of where they get their news and information. So it's a lot harder to achieve top-of-mind awareness. They're a lot more expensive than it used to. And then the other thing is that we are all surrounded all the time by marketing messages that consumers have gotten very smart and very jaded about that kind of thing and consistently tune out those kind of messages, whether it's what we call banner blindness online, where people don't look at the banner ads and they'll click on them. And, you know, even in newspapers, if you're like, yeah, whatever, I'm going right to the story. So top-of-mind awareness is a lot harder than it used to be. And then so what has sort of filled the historical vacuum behind top-of-mind awareness is what I call frame-of-mind awareness. And that's where we get into the whole sort of realm of search marketing and inbound marketing. And the notion there is that if you create something, people will find you when they're ready. They will look for an answer, and you just sort of have to step in front of that train, like, oh, I need socks, you're socks.com, right? And they will find you and buy from you. And obviously, you know, I'm a proponent of search marketing and inbound marketing. I've been in online for a long time, and it can really, really work. But here's the thing. Nobody goes to Google and says, hey, I'd like to buy something today. I don't really care what. Just surprise me, right? Yeah. It doesn't work like that. By the time you go to a search engine, you already have a pretty strong idea of what it is that you want. And so that doesn't make it a bad marketing tactic. It just makes it a somewhat limited marketing tactic, because that kind of frame of mind awareness program doesn't create new demand for your products and services. It just harvests demand that already exists. So the third way to do this, and the way I talk about in the book, is what I call friend of mine awareness. And this is the notion that companies behave like our friends behave, and that they are useful and genuine and kind. And if you do that, then your customers and prospective customers will remember you and will give you the benefit of the doubt and will buy from you and support you. And if you look at social media in particular, all the different ways that companies interact in social media are set up so that those companies behave like individuals. What's the difference between a company Twitter account and a personal Twitter account? None. What's the difference between a Facebook business page and a Facebook personal page? About this much. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between a Google Plus business page and a Google Plus personal page? About this much, right? So it's all set up to have companies behave more like people. And that's actually great. It's on trend. If companies can be useful the way our friends are useful, things will happen for them, and it works actually best, I feel, for small companies and entrepreneurs.
So could you give an example of this? Like, what would it mean to be useful exactly?
So the place that I first started thinking about utility in this concept was 3 summers ago. I was in Canada. I originally went to Kelowna, Canada, with my son and my family for a hockey camp. For my son, and then we took a little family trip across Canada, and we ended up in Banff. And Banff, Alberta, is a very popular ski town in Canada, beautiful tourist area, lots of lakes and mountains and moose and bears and bald eagles, whatever. And it's a very popular tourist destination, lots and lots of bars and restaurants in Banff, and consequently there's lots and lots of taxi drivers. But there's only one taxi driver in Banff who is a utility, who really plays this friend of mine awareness game exceptionally well, and that is a guy by the name of Taxi Mike. And this is Taxi Mike's publication here. Once a quarter, Taxi Mike makes this where to eat guide in Banff, and as you can probably tell here on the hangout, Taxi Mike is not a professional graphic designer. So it's okay, but so once he makes this on in like Mac Paint or something and goes to his local copy shop and makes tons of copies of this. And then when you're in Banff, you'll see this all over the place. All the different bars and restaurants have this guide on their front counter. In fact, I was just there 3 weeks ago and saw a bunch of them. But what's amazing about this is if you look in here, Taxi Mike has categorized all the bars and restaurants in the town. So best place for casual lunch, best place for nice lunch, best place for Canadian food, which is right on my alley, best happy hour, etc. So he's like a one-man trip advisor. And you pick this up, and at the end of the night, when you've been in Banff and you're rolling around down, and there's also a map of downtown right here, at the end of the night, you're not going to ask the bartender to call you a taxi, because right here in your pocket is this, and it says, oh, Taxi Mike, there's his phone number right there, Banff Taxi. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is a great example of a company or business, an entrepreneur behaving like a useful friend and reaping the rewards as a result.
And you know what, Jay, though, with this particular flyer, even though he may not be a professional graphic designer, he still did take the elements, because I imagine when you're a tourist, you would have that flyer in your hand all day long just to see where to go next. And it does have the yellow background and those little checkered little thingies on it. So immediately you're thinking taxi subconsciously all day long. So even though it's not the most beautiful thing, it's definitely something that will have you as a friend of mine exactly call Mike later on to that day. So I wanted to ask you, though, you mentioned earlier about the different personal profiles and company profiles having the same basic behaviors online and the different social networks. So I'm wondering, why do you think, or is it something that we can change in terms of, for example, Google+? It does not let you, according at least to the rules, that to behave as a company on your personal profile on, or whatever they call it, on Google+. Mm-hmm. And for example, when we are trying to set up the Google+ page for Born to Influence, it would not accept that name, Born to Influence, as first name, last name. You have to have a page.
Right.
Do you have anything, any workaround? Not even a workaround, but like any explanation on how we can actually make use of it and still connect with people rather than as a page?
Well, they do that mostly for, for privacy reasons, right? Or actually the opposite, for non-privacy reasons. Google+, I've written about this in the past on my blog, Google+ and Facebook have learned from MySpace's lesson, right? So MySpace had a system where you did not have to use a real name to have an account. Or you could say, I'm Martha Stewart. You know, I'm Oprah. And, well, oh, you must be Oprah. And so anybody could just make any name that you wanted. Now, what Google+ does is they tie your page name to your Google identity. So they know that you're an actual person. They know that this is the real you. And that reduces enormously fraud and just nonsense and craziness within the channel. So while it is a little bit restrictive to kind of do the things you're trying to do, that sometimes you want to use some of the functionality that's only available to people, but you can't do that because you're not a people, you're actually a business. But when you sort of take a step back and recognize that what they're trying to do is prevent businesses, not that this is what you're doing, but what they're trying to do is, A, make sure that the people who are on that actually go by a real identity for safety reasons, and two, that they do not allow businesses to abuse the system by spamming people and things like that. So it can be a little bit irksome sometimes, the way that functionality is set up. Facebook, same thing. But on the whole, I think it's probably for the best.
That really makes much more sense. Thank you so much for clarifying that. Sure. And really, I wanted to ask you also about how do you see the future going in terms of companies and people sort of merging in the public eye and becoming really more useful and behaving as a friend? How can you initiate that type of culture in your company if that's maybe not the path that you were on or not fully dedicated to before?
And it is a cultural shift. You have to realize that helping beats selling, at least eventually. And what that requires is for companies of all sizes to realize that you're playing the long game, or you should be playing the long game. It's about making a customer for life, not necessarily making a customer today. And that requires you to sometimes do something like this, where maybe I'm not going to call him today, but eventually I'm probably going to call him, right? And it's the eventually that matters. And so that takes patience. And what Gary Vaynerchuk says is we have to market more like farmers and less like hunters. And he's exactly right. You have to give these kind of programs time to work. And some people, especially entrepreneurs and small businesses, are not very good at patience. Right, it's not their, you know, not their prime skill set, and you have to understand that, you know, typically success goes like this, right? It's not very often that it's like that, but everybody reads the hockey stick growth case study and thinks that that's what they want to do, and that's the only way to succeed, and it is absolutely not. You know, my company has grown 40% a year, exactly 40% a year for 5 years in a row. And once we get to 40% for the year, we shut it down. We refuse to grow faster than that year over year. Because I don't want to do this. Because when you do this, it takes your life and throws it in a snow globe, right? We do this. Yeah. Same thing with the blog, same thing with the podcast and the email. It's steady incremental growth. But you have to be thinking about, okay, what am I trying to achieve 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? But so often as entrepreneurs, people think about what am I doing Monday? And that's how you get into a social media circumstance where you're like, sell, 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 click here, buy from us. And it's just not what people want. They just do not want that kind of approach. And so I'm seeing more and more companies realizing that the great irony of social media and online marketing is that it happens really fast, but the benefits accrue slowly.
So what kind of questions can we be asking ourselves in order to plan in this way, in order to really plan our content creation and social media and customer relations and so forth, you know, a year in advance so we don't get these sell, sell, sell circumstances? How do we plan this? How do we strategize for this?
Well, the reality is that most of the content that you can and should create, certainly most of the utilities like this, are things that transcend the transaction. It's not about your products and services per se, right? It's about things that matter to your customers or prospective customers that are related to your products and services. That's the best kind of utility. So what you really have to understand is, what do people really need? What's the bigger story that you're trying to tell? I just saw one this morning, as a matter of fact. I got in my email a infographic from the Cleveland Clinic, which I did some speaking for recently. They're a very famous medical center in Cleveland, ironically, that is one of the most noteworthy sort of hospital systems in the U.S. And they have this great infographic, and it's, should you take ibuprofen or acetaminophen, right? So basically, should you take Advil or Tylenol in a mm-hmm. brand sense? And it has this whole checklist about what, you know, what's wrong with you, and then which one should you take. Now, they're not in that business, right? They don't sell Advil or Tylenol. And if you only need an Advil, you're probably not coming to the hospital. But it's a very common question that people have. And now I'm like, oh, that's great. I'll actually hold on to that or bookmark it. I'm like, oh, thanks, Cleveland Clinic. So when I do have something really wrong with me, I think of them first. And so that's a good example of understanding what the bigger story is, what the bigger need is, and giving people that. And that's what you need to sit down initially and say, okay, what are all the questions that people have? And what do people not know about you? And you answer those questions methodically. That's the first step.
Mm-hmm. And what is there a second step, since you said first step?
Well, the first step is to answer all those questions. And the second step is to say, okay, is to say, well, where do those answers live, right? So if you say, okay, the question is should I take acetaminophen or ibuprofen? That's the question. That's the bigger question. Okay, well, where should that answer be? Should it be an infographic, as they did? Should it be a video? Should it be a Vine video? Should it be a blog post? Should it be an event? Should it be a direct mail piece? Should it be, you know, skywriting? I don't know. In many cases, you should make multiple examples of those executions, right? The best practice is to do it in different ways, in different places. But you have to understand a couple of things about your audience. What do they need, and how do they prefer to consume information? Mm-hmm. A lot of times people say, well, what we should do is, you know, let's just make this a video. Well, maybe your audiences don't use video. Or let's do this on Instagram, but maybe your audience is older, they don't use Instagram, right? So you have to fit the content channel to the audience, and sometimes people don't think of that very well.
I think this really ties back into what you mentioned in the very beginning as well, that there is no such thing as mass market in the old sense of the world anymore, like the big newspapers and big TV channels, because the audience is so fragmented. And you mentioned that it became more expensive to find those tiny little niches. And this would be one example to address them through video and a podcast and an infographic or whatever you have. But how can we find, and what are some of the things that we can do in order to find those people to really tap into the correct segments of the market or to the correct channels, rather than just dispersing our energy all over the place trying to be everywhere but not really having any results? Or what are some of the methods to measure that, so you know how long do I have to give it in this particular channel before I know where it makes sense to continue or to drop it?
Well, the first thing to look at is where are people talking about your company or your category of business today? I mean, those conversations are already happening, certainly online. So using social media listening software or tools of that nature to figure out, okay, excuse me, are these conversations happening on Twitter? Are they happening on blogs? If so, what blogs? Are they happening in LinkedIn groups? Are they happening on podcasts? If so, what podcasts? Right. So finding those venues for conversation is really important. And then the second step, and this sounds ridiculously obvious, but if it was so obvious, everybody do it, which is just ask your customers, right? So literally sit down with your customers and say, or do a survey and say, where and how do you consume information? What do you read? What do you watch? Where do you hang out, right? And use those, what we call media habits survey. Use that data to help plan where and how you create content.
This is one question that I have when I was reading your book. You had a really great example. I think it was Hilton that was using mm-hmm. Twitter to sort of be helpful mm-hmm. for people who were asking, I don't remember the example exactly, but which great restaurants are there in the area? And Hilton would come in and suggest restaurants that weren't necessarily, that didn't have anything to do with Hilton,
yep.
but simply to be friendly and so forth. So I'm sort of thinking, you know, for those of us who aren't Hilton and who don't have a huge marketing team and so forth, does being friendly require that we have a full-time person constantly listening to social media and answering questions and so forth? Like, what are we talking about here?
So I'll give you an example from my first book, The Now Revolution. There is a company in New Brunswick, Canada, called Martel Home Builders, small builder of homes up there. And they were in pretty big trouble a few years ago, bad economy for home buying. And more to the point, almost all of the homes that they were selling were coming through realtors. And I'm not anti-realtor, I love realtors, but the commissions that they were paying to realtors was cutting into their profit margin a lot, and it was a problem. So they said, look, we've got to find a way. I think it was 80% of their sales were through realtors. Mm-hmm. And they said, we got to find a way to get more customers direct, and we don't have any money. So what should we do? Well, what if we just are friendly and useful and transparent? So they started a blog, and the blog is really interesting because it almost never talks about Martel Home Builders or even homes. It provides information that people who need to buy a home or might want to buy a home might want to know. So it's things like, what kind of flower should you plant in your front yard? Or what's a better use of remodeling dollars, remodeling a kitchen or remodeling a bathroom? What are the best ways to pack valuables or breakables when you move? It's things like that. It's very similar to the acetaminophen versus ibuprofen mm-hmm. idea, right? Where's the bigger mm-hmm. story there? So that blog was very effective. They made some interesting videos as well. But to your point, their CEO, Pierre Martel, started a Twitter account and just set up a bunch of searches, a bunch of keyword searches, mostly around New Brunswick and some of the cities that they operate in. And so he would get alerts sent to him via email, or he'd kind of, have Twitter up on his second monitor kind of thing throughout the day. And when he saw people talking about New Brunswick or having questions about New Brunswick, he would jump into those conversations and say, oh, hey, by the way, I'm from New Brunswick. What questions can I answer for you? Do you need to know information about schools, about doctors, about dentists, about restaurants? I'm happy to help. Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, we sell houses.
Right, of course.
They increased their sales over a two-year period by 400% increase in sales. And the percentage of sales coming through realtors went from 80% to
12%. Wow.
Now, I can't say that's only because of Twitter. It's not like it's only because of Twitter, but mm-hmm. it's really, I mean, he's one guy. One guy, $0, and can do this effectively. What that kind of marketing requires is not budget, it's time. And if I have a dollar for every time an entrepreneur told me they don't have time for this kind of thing, I would already be retired, because that's the constant question or objection amongst entrepreneurs. I don't have time for that. Well, guess what? You've got to make time. And the reality is, look, I am old. I remember the days before we had email, right? Literally, I was working.
Jay, I remember too. Does that make me old?
You're like 17. You have no idea what you're talking about. We actually would get out of our chair and walk down the hall to have conversations with coworkers. It was an amazing time. And so, you know, but we made, now you think about how much time you spend every day on email, right? And so we made time to do email because you had to. And you have to make time for this. The same way that you make time to go to the gym or watch TV or dick around on your iPad or whatever your story is, take some of that time and devote it every day to paying attention in social media and helping people, and eventually really good things will happen. But you have to schedule it, like literally in your calendar, Mondays, 10 to 10:30, helping people on Twitter. Right? Yeah. That's what
I
it
like
is.
That.
And what I'm hearing as well is that you can create time by systematizing it as well, by creating saved searches, or you mentioned listening, different kinds of listening software as well. Could you tell us a bit more about how we can systematize these kind of things? What kind of, is there any software we can be using? You know, any kind of helpful tips and tricks here?
Well, that concludes part one of this interview with Jay Baer. But not to worry, we'll be back tomorrow with part two. And in the meantime, I wanted to thank you so much for leaving those wonderful reviews and emails and messages that we've been getting. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I wanted to ask you if you would hop on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/born to influence and leave a comment there on what was your number one biggest takeaway that you took from today's interview with Jay Baer. I know that he would very much appreciate to see it, and so would Meta and myself as well. And otherwise, I'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.